enough, but there's a small H at the bottom of the page of the calendar that we don't understand. The legendary superintendent has aged. His blonde beard is thick, and his matted hair is hanging down over his ears and curling at the back of his neck, over the padded collar of his jacket. The films suggest narcissism, obviously, she goes on, sitting down on a stainless steel stool with her legs wide apart. Yuna is thinking about the perpetrator watching the woman through the window. He can come as close as he wants, but there's still a pane of glass between them. It's intimate, but he's still shut out. He wants to communicate something, Margot says. He wants to make a point, or compete, match his strength against the police, because he feels so damn strong and smart, while the police are still miles behind him. And that feeling of invincibility is going to lead to more murders. Yuna looks over at the first victim, and his eye is caught by her white hand, resting beside her hip, cupped like a small bowl, like a mussel shell. He stands up with some effort, with the help of his stick, thinking that something attracted the perpetrator to Maria Carlson, made him cross his boundary as an observer. And that's why, Margot goes on, that strong sense of superiority is why I think there could be some sort of signature that we haven't seen. She falls silent when Yuna walks away from her, heading towards the post-mortem table with weary steps. He stops in front of the body and leans on his stick. His heavy leather aviator's jacket is open, its sheepskin lining visible. As he leans over the body, his holster and Colt Combat come into view. She stands up and feels the child in her belly has woken up. It falls asleep when she moves about and wakes up if she sits or lies down. She holds one hand to her stomach as she walks over to Yuna. He's looking closely at the victim's ravaged face. It's like he doesn't believe she's dead, as if he wanted to feel her moist breath against his mouth. What are you thinking? Margot asks. Sometimes I think that our idea of justice is still in its infancy, Yuna replies, without taking his eyes from the dead woman. Okay, she says. So what does that make the law? He asks. I could give you an answer, but I'm guessing you have a different one in mind. Yuna straightens up, thinking that the law chases justice the way Lumi used to chase spots of reflected light when she was little. Orlean follows the original post-mortem as he conducts his own. The usual purpose of an external examination is to describe visible injuries, such as swellings, discoloration, scraped skin, bleeding, scratches and cuts. But this time, he is searching for something that could have been overlooked between two observations, something beyond the obvious. Most of the stab wounds aren't fatal, and that wasn't the point of them either, Orlean says to Margot and Yuna. If it was, they wouldn't have been aimed at her face. Hatred is stronger than the desire to kill, Margot says. He wanted to destroy her face, Orlean nods. Or change it, Margot says. Why is her mouth gaping like that? Yuna asks quietly. Her jaw is broken, Orlean says. There are traces of her own saliva on her fingers. Was there anything in her mouth or throat? Yuna asks. Nothing. Yuna is thinking about the perpetrator standing outside, filming her as she puts on her tights. At that point, he is an observer who needs, or at least accepts, the boundary presented by the thin glass of the window. But something lures him over that boundary, he repeats to himself as he borrows Orlean's thin torch. He shines it into the dead woman's mouth. Her saliva has dried up and her throat is pale grey. There's no sign of anything in her throat. Her tongue has retracted, and the inside of her cheeks are dark. In the middle of her tongue, at its thickest part, is a tiny hole from a piece of jewelry. It could almost be part of the natural fold of the tongue, but Yuna is sure her tongue was pierced. He goes over and looks at the first report and reads the description of the mouth and stomach. "What are you looking for?" Ulian asks. "The only notes under points 22 and 23 are the injuries to the lips, teeth and gums, and at point 62 it says that the tongue and hyoid bone are undamaged. But there's no mention of the hole." Yuna carries on reading, but there's no mention of any item of jewelry being found in the stomach or gut. "I want to see the film," he says. "It's already been examined tens of thousands of times," Margot says. Leaning heavily on his stick, Yuna raises his face, and his grey eyes are now as dark as thunderclouds. Chapter 29. Margot signs Yuna in as her guest at the reception of the National Criminal Investigation Department, and he has to put on a visitor's badge before they pass through the security doors. "There are bound to be loads of people wanting to see you," Margot says as they walk towards the lifts. "I haven't got time," he says, taking his badge off and throwing it in a waste paper bin. "It's probably a good idea to prepare yourself for shaking a few hands. Can you manage that?" Yuna thinks of the mines he laid out behind the house in Natavara. He made the ANNM out of ammonium nitrate and nitromethane so that he had a stable secondary explosive substance. He had already armed two mines with 3 grams of pentaerythritol tetranitrate as a detonator, and was on his way back to the outhouse to make the third detonator when the entire bag of PETN exploded. The heavy door was blown off and knocked his right leg out of its socket. The pain had been like a flock of black birds, heavy jackdaws landing on his body and covering the ground where he lay. They rose again as though they'd been blown away when Lumi ran over to him and held his hand in hers. "At least I've still got my hands," he says as they pass a group of sofa and armchairs. "That makes it easier." Margot holds the lift door open and waits for him to catch up. "I don't know what you think you're going to see on the video," she says. "No," he says, and follows her in. "I mean, you seem pretty bloody weird," she smiles, "but I almost think I like that." When they emerge from the lift, the corridor is already full of their colleagues. Everyone comes out of their rooms, leaving a passageway open between them. Yuna doesn't look anyone in the eye, doesn't smile back at anyone, and doesn't answer anyone. He knows what he looks like. His beard is long and his hair scruffy. He's limping and leaning on his stick, and he can't stand up straight. No one seems to know how to handle his return. They want to see him, but they mostly seem rather shy. Someone's holding a bundle of papers, someone else a mug of coffee. These are people he saw every day for many years. He walks past Benny Rubin, who's standing eating a banana with a neutral expression on his face. "I'll go as soon as I've seen the film," Yuna tells Margot as he carries on past the doorway of his old room. "We're working in room 22, Margot says, pointing along the corridor. Yuna stops to catch his breath for a moment. His injured leg hurts, and he presses the stick into the floor to give his body a break.
"Which rubbish tip did you find him on?"
Petr Neslund says with a grin. "Idiot," Margot says. The head of the National Criminal Police, Carlos Eliasson, comes towards Yuna. His reading glasses are swinging on a chain round his neck.
"Yuna," he says warmly.
"Yes," Yuna replies. They shake hands, and patchy applause breaks out in the corridor.
I didn't believe it when they said you were in the building, Carlos says, unable to contain his smile. I mean, I can't really take it in.
I just want to look at something, Yona says, and tries to walk on.
Come and see me afterwards, and we'll have a talk about the future.
What's there to say about that? Yona says, and walks away. His work there feels distant now, further away than his childhood. There's nothing for me to come back to, he thinks. He wouldn't be here now if the first victim's hand hadn't been cupped like a little bowl by her hip. That made a small spark begin to smolder inside him. Her slender fingers could have been Lumi's. A deep-seated curiosity woke up inside him, and he suddenly felt compelled to get closer to the body.
We need you here,
Magdalena Runanda says as they shake hands. It's no longer his job, but when he was confronted with the first victim, he felt a connection that he'd like to be able to control. Maybe he can give Margot a hand with the early stages, just until she can see a way through. Yuna stumbles as pain shoots down his leg. His shoulder hits the wall, and he hears his leather jacket scrape against the rough wallpaper. I put a note on the internet that you were going to be coming, Margot says as they stop outside room 822. Anya Larsson, his assistant for all those years, is standing in the doorway of her room. Her face is red. Her chin starts to quiver and tears well up in her eyes as he stops in front of her.
I've missed you, Anya, he says.
Have you?
Yuna nods and looks her in the eye. His pale grey eyes have a dull shimmer, as if he had a fever.
Everyone said you were dead. That you'd... But I couldn't believe that. I didn't want to. I suppose I always thought you were too stubborn to die.
She smiles as tears run down her cheeks.
It just wasn't my time, he replies.
The corridor starts to empty as everyone returns to their rooms. They've already seen enough of the fallen hero.
What do you look like?
Anya says, wiping her nose on the sleeve of her blouse.
I know,
he says simply. She pats his cheek.
You'd better go, Yuna. They're waiting for you.
Chapter 30 Yuna enters the operations room and closes the door behind him. On the long wall is a huge map of Stockholm with the crime scenes marked on it. Next to the map, pictures from the examination of the scenes have been stuck up. Footprints, bodies, blood spatter patterns. There's a large photograph of the porcelain deer's head with its reddish-brown glazed fur and eyes like black onyx. Yuna looks at the copy of Maria Carlsson's Filofax. The day she was murdered, she had written Class 1900, squared paper, pencils, ink. And underneath she had scribbled the letter H. On the other wall, they've tried to map the victims' profiles. They've begun to identify family connections and other relationships. Their movements, workplaces, friends, supermarkets, gyms, classes, buses, cafes, have been marked with pins. Adam Youssef stands up from his computer and walks over to Yuna, shakes his hand, then pins a picture of a kitchen knife on the wall.
It's just been confirmed that this knife was the murder weapon. Björn Kern washed it up and put it back in the drawer, but we had a number of stab wounds through the sternum, so it was fairly easy to reconstruct the type of blade we were looking for, and it turned out that there were still tiny traces of blood on it.
Yusuf catches his breath, scratches his head hard a couple of times, then moves on to the enlargement of the deer's head.
The porcelain figure is made of meissen china, he says, letting his finger linger over the animal's glistening black eye. But the rest of the deer wasn't at the crime scene. Björn Kern hasn't yet been able to give any sort of coherent statement, so we don't know if he was the one who put it in her hand.
Yuna stops and looks at the photograph of Maria Karlsson's body. The dead woman is sitting propped up against a radiator under a window wearing a pair of tights. He reads the report from the examination of the crime scene. There's no mention of any tongue stud or similar item of jewellery being found in her home. Adam shoots a questioning glance at Margot behind Yuna's back.
He wants to look at the film of Maria Karlsson, she says.
Okay, what for?
She smiles. We've missed something.
Probably,
he laughs and scratches his neck. You can borrow my computer, Margot says amiably. Yuna thanks her and sits down on her chair, adjusts the media player to full screen and starts the clip. Just as Margot has described, it shows a 30-year-old woman filmed in secret through her bedroom window as she pulls on a pair of black tights. He sees her face completely unaware, her downturned eyes, the calm set of her mouth, which then switches to something approaching lethargy. Her hair is hanging round her face. It looks like it's just been washed. She's wearing a black bra, and she's trying to get her tights to sit properly. There's a lamp with a clouded white shade and alabaster base in the window, and her shadow moves across the chest of drawers and the flowery wallpaper. She slips her hand between her thighs and tries to pull the thin nylon material up towards her crotch, and he can see her breathing through her mouth as the film ends.
"Did you see what you were looking for?"
Adam asks, leaning over Yuna's shoulder. Yuna remains seated in front of the screen, then plays the film again, watches her struggle with her tights, then freezes the picture after 35 seconds and clicks to advance it frame by frame.
"We've done that too,"
Adam says, stifling a belch. Yuna moves closer to the screen and watches Maria Karlsson as she moves very slowly, breathing with her mouth open. Her eyes blink and her long lashes cast shadows across her cheeks. Her right hand sinks weightlessly between her thighs to her crotch.
"This won't do," Adam says to Margot. "We need to get on."
"Give him a chance," she replies. Maria Karlsson turns jerkily towards the camera. The grey shadow crosses her face as if she were being lifted up from a bath full of lead. Her lips part. The light from the lamp in the window shines on her face, making her eyes glow, and there's a shimmer in her mouth. Then the film ends. Behind Yuna, Adam and Margot have started to talk about investigating the people in the drawing class that Maria was about to set out for. They've already tried to find out if any of their names begin with H, but without success so far. Yuna moves the cursor and plays the last 5 seconds again. The light plays across her hair, her ear and cheeks, making her eyes shine, and then her mouth flashes. He enlarges the image as far as he can without losing too much focus, then shifts the enlarged area so that it covers her mouth and looks at the last few frames again. Her parted lips fill the screen. Light shines in and the pink tip of her tongue becomes visible. He clicks to advance the image frame by frame. The curve of her tongue comes into view, becomes lighter, and in the next shot, it looks like a white sun fills the whole of her mouth. The sun contracts, and in the penultimate frame, the glow has shrunk to a white dot on a grey pea.
"He took the jewellery,"
Yuna says quietly. The two detectives fall silent and turn to look at him and the computer screen. It takes a few moments for them to interpret the enlarged image, the pink tongue and hazy stud.
"Okay, we missed the fact that her tongue was pierced," Adam says in a rasping voice.
Margot is standing with her legs apart and her hands round her stomach and looks at Yuna as he leans against the desk and gets up from the chair. You saw that she had a hole in her tongue and wanted to watch the film to see if the stud was there, she says, picking up her phone. I just thought her mouth was important, Yuna says. Her jaw was broken, and she had her own saliva on her hand. Impressive, Margot says. I'll request an enlargement from forensics at once. Yuna stands still, staring at the pictures and maps on the wall as Margot speaks into the phone. We are collaborating with the BKA, Margot explains once she's hung up. The Germans are way out in front when it comes to this sort of thing, in all forms of image enhancement. Have you met Stefan Ott? Handsome guy, curly hair. He's developed his own programs, which J-Lab... Okay, so we've got an item of jewelry on the film, Adam says, thinking out loud. The degree of violence is aggressive, fueled by hatred, probably jealousy, and Margot's inbox bleeps, and she opens the email and clicks on the image so that it fills the whole screen. In order to improve the contrast of the stud itself, the image enhancement software has changed all the colors. Maria Carlsson's tongue and cheeks are blue, almost like glass, but at the same time, the stud is clearly visible. Saturn, Margot whispers. At the end of the stud, piercing Maria's tongue, is a silver sphere with a ring around its equator, just like the planet Saturn. That's not an H, Yuna says. They turn and see that he's looking at the photograph of Maria's Filofax, where it says Class 1900, squared paper, pencils, ink. Then, on the line below, the letter H. That's the symbol for Saturn, he says. It actually represents a scythe or sickle. That's why it's slightly crooked, and sometimes it's crossed up at the top. Saturn, the planet, the Roman god, Margot says. Chapter 31. Yuna and Margot have taken their shoes off and are standing looking through a pane of glass. The room inside is warm and damp. I've tested for allergens, and it turns out that I'm allergic to mindfulness, she says. To the strains of Indian music, about 30 perspiring women are moving with mechanical symmetry on their yoga mats. Margot got 5 officers to check through Maria Carlsson's internet traffic once more, her email, Facebook, and Instagram accounts. The stud in her tongue is only visible in a few pictures and is only mentioned by one of her friends on Facebook, before all communication between them ceased. You got lick it before we kick it. Me too wanna pierce my tongue. The woman who had posted that was called Linda Barryman, and she was an instructor in Bikram yoga in the center of Stockholm. They were in very regular contact for 6 months before she suddenly unfriended Maria. Linda Barryman emerges from the staff room dressed in jeans and a grey sweater. She's suntanned and has quickly showered and put on some makeup. Linda, I'm Margot Silverman, Margot says, shaking the woman's hand. You didn't say what this was about, and I can honestly say that I have absolutely no idea, she says. They walk along the pavement in the direction of Nora Bantoriet. While Margot tries to get Linda to relax by asking about Bikram yoga. It's a form of Hatha yoga, but takes place in a room with high humidity at a temperature of 40 degrees, Linda explains. They enter the former playground in front of the old Nora Latin school. The spherical fountain shimmers silvery white, and the wind keeps scattering showers of tiny droplets. The founder's name is Bikram Chowdhury. He created a series of 26 positions that are actually the best I've ever tried, she goes on. Let's sit down, Margot says, patting her stomach.
They sit down on an empty park bench beside the fence facing Olof Palme's gata.
You used to be friends with Maria Karlsson on Facebook, Yuna says, drawing a deep vertical line in the path, raising a little cloud of dust.
What's happened? She asks warily.
Why did you unfriend her?
Because we no longer have anything to do with each other.
But you seem to have been in very close contact for several months, Margot says.
She came to a few classes, and we started talking, and...
Linda tails off, and her gaze flits anxiously from Margot to Yuna.
What did you talk about? Margot asks.
Can I ask if I'm suspected of having done something?
You're not, Yuna says.
You knew that Maria had a piercing, that she had a tongue stud, Margot goes on.
Yes, Linda says, and gives a slightly embarrassed smile.
Did she have several different studs?
No.
Do you remember what hers looked like?
Yes.
Linda stares at the old school building and the play of the shadows under the trees for a moment before replying.
It had a tiny model of Saturn at the top.
A tiny model of Saturn, Margot repeats, very gently.
What does that mean?
I don't know,
Linda says blankly. Is it to do with astrology? Linda looks over at the trees again and kicks the ground with her trainers.
Do you know where she got it from?
It doesn't seem to be for sale anywhere. Not from any of the usual internet sites, anyway.
I don't understand where this is going, Linda says. I've got another class soon, and
Maria Karlsson's dead,
Margot interrupts with quiet seriousness. She was murdered last week.
Murdered? She was murdered?
Yes. She was found on...
Why are you telling me?
Linda interrupts and stands up.
Please sit down, Margot says.
Maria's dead?
Linda sits down. Her eyes drift off towards the fountain, and she starts to cry.
But I...
She shakes her head and hides her face in her hands.
Did you give her the stud?
Yuna asks.
Why the hell do you keep going on about that tongue stud?
She snaps.
Find the killer instead. This is completely sick.
Did you give her the stud?
Yuna repeats, drawing a short line across the first one.
No, I didn't,
she replies, wiping the tears from her cheeks.
She got it from a guy.
Do you know the name of the guy? Margot asks.
I don't want to get involved,
she whispers.
We respect that, Margot nods.
Linda looks at her with bloodshot eyes and purses her lips.
His name is Philip Kronstedt,
she says quietly.
Do you know where he lives?
No.
Was Maria going out with him?
Linda doesn't answer, just stares down at the ground as the tears begin to fall again. Yuna adds the last curve to the symbol with his stick and leans back.
Why did she have a model of Saturn on her tongue stud? Margot asks carefully.
What does it mean?
I don't know. Because it looked nice,
she says weakly.
In Maria's diary, there's a symbol written in 10 different places. It's the old symbol for Saturn, Margot says, and points to the ground.
Chapter 32. Linda's cheeks turn red as she looks at the symbol drawn in the grit in front of Yuna's feet. The stylized scythe has already begun to be erased by the wind. She says nothing, but her forehead is shiny with sweat.
Sorry, but I'm expecting a phone call,
Yuna says, and stands up with the help of his stick. Margot watches him limp off towards the steps of the Nora Latin school and pull out his mobile. She understands that he's left them alone to give her a chance to create a more intimate atmosphere between her and Linda Barryman.
Linda, she says, I'm going to find out what all this is about sooner or later, but I'd rather you told me.
The young woman has dark grey sweat marks under her arms now as she slowly brushes the hair from her face.
It's just a bit personal,
she says, licking her lips again. I appreciate that.
They call it Saturnalia,
Linda says, looking down at the ground. Is that some sort of role play? Margot asks gently.
No, it's an orgy,
Linda replies as steadily as she can.
Group sex? Yes, although group sex sounds like, I don't know, it's not like some sort of tragic old swingers club.
She smiles, embarrassed.
You seem to know what you're talking about, Margot goes on. I went with Maria a few times, she replies, shaking her head almost imperceptibly. I'm single. It was nothing funny. You didn't have to sleep with everyone just because you were there.
But isn't that the point?
I don't have any regrets about trying it, but it's not exactly something I'm proud of either.
Tell me about the Saturnalias, Margot asks quietly.
I don't know what to say, Linda says, crossing her legs. I was carried along by Maria's, I don't know, completely open attitude about sex. Well, I thought I was, anyway.
Were you in love with her?
I did it for my own sake, Linda said, without answering the question. To try something new, no obligation, just to let go and allow it to mean nothing but sex.
I can understand that, Margot smiles gently.
The first time, Linda says, giving Margot a dark look, your whole body just shakes. You think, I can't be doing this. Several men at the same time, and there are loads of drugs, and you have sex with other girls, and it goes on for hours. It's mad.
She looks over towards Yuna and brushes the sweat from her top lip with her forefinger.
But you stopped going, Margot says. I'm not like Maria. I wanted to be with her, and I tried doing it her way, and after a while I felt different and brave and everything. But after the third time, I started to think a whole load of things. It wasn't like I regretted it, more like, okay, why am I doing this? I don't have to feel ashamed. I'm allowed to do it. But why?
That's a good question.
It was my decision to go, but it sort of wasn't on my terms. I think I felt a bit exploited, in spite of all that.
Was that why you stopped? Linda rubs the end of her nose and says quietly,
I'd had enough when it turned out that someone had filmed one of the Saturnalias. You're not supposed to do that. No mobiles. Maria called and told me. She was really angry, but it just made me worried. I felt like I was going to be sick. The film clip was on a porn site for amateur films. It was shaky and dark, but I could still see myself, and that wasn't exactly a great feeling, I can tell you.
A few drops from the fountain reach them, and Linda turns away from the hazy sphere and shakes her head.
I can't believe she's dead, she whispers.
These Saturnalias, how are they arranged?
It's two guys from Östermalm, Philip and someone called Eugene. It probably started out as them having parties where there was a lot of cocaine and ecstasy. And then there was spice, monkey dust, Spanish fly, and all the rest of it. And now it's been going on for at least 2 or 3 years. There are maybe a couple of Saturnalias every month. Exclusive. Invite only.
Always on Saturdays?
You know where the English word Saturday comes from?
Linda replies, looking her in the eye. Margot nods, and Linda kicks at the ground again.
I'd just like to say that I never took any drugs, she says.
Good for you, Margot says neutrally.
I drank too much champagne instead.
She smiles.
Where do they take place? When I was involved, they had a suite at the Birger Jarl Hotel. All I remember is really weird, psychedelic rooms.
Tell me about the stud Maria had in her tongue. Philip and Eugene gave studs to all the girls who belonged to the inner circle. Did Maria want to leave as well, do you know?
I don't think so. Well, I...
She falls silent and gathers her hair over one shoulder.
What were you going to say?
Just that Philip fell in love with her. He wanted to see her on her own, didn't want her sleeping with other men. She just laughed. That was what she was like, Maria.
Margot pulls out a photograph of Susanna Kern. Do you recognize this woman? Take a good look.
Linda looks at Susanna Kern's smiling face, her warm, light brown eyes and glossy hair, and shakes her head.
No, she replies. Was she at the Saturnalias?
I don't recognize her, Linda says, getting to her feet. Margot remains seated on the bench, thinking that they still haven't found a connection between the victims. They're dealing with a serial killer who stalks his victims, but they have no idea where he finds them or how he chooses them.
Chapter 33.
Madeleine Federer is walking with her mother along a path that cuts diagonally across Humlegården. After school, she went with her to play in St. Jakob's Church. Jackie takes all the extra work she can get as an organist so that they can manage financially. Now Madeleine is walking along next to her mother, talking and keeping an eye on the path, even though she knows that her mum doesn't need help. Her mother walks with one foot nudging the edge of the grass so she can feel the plants against her leg and at the same time listen to the stick tapping the path. A compressor starts to rumble outside the Royal Library, and powerful drills begin digging at the asphalt with rapid metallic thuds. The noise means that her mother loses her bearings, and Madeleine takes hold of her arm. They pass the playground with the spiral slide she used to love when she was younger. It smelled so good of plastic and warm sand. When they reach the street, her mother thanks her for her help, and they carry on towards the pedestrian crossing. Madeleine can hear how the tapping of the stick against the stone pavement sounds harder than it did on the tarmac. But she can't tell how it sounds when they pass a pole close to the edge of the road.
It's just a momentary gap in the noise of the cars, her mother explains, and stops.
As usual, she puts the tip of her stick over the edge of the pavement so that she'll be prepared for the change in height when the cars stop and the ticking sound from the traffic lights speeds up. They cross and walk along in front of a large yellow building when her mother turns towards an open garage door and clicks her tongue. A lot of people with visual impairments do this to listen to the echo and identify potential hazards. Once they're home, Jackie closes the door, locks it, and engages the security chain. Madeleine hangs up her coat and watches her mum go into the living room without switching the light on and put her music scores on the table. Madeleine goes to her room, says hello to Hoggy, and just has time to change into some home clothes before she hears her mother's voice.
Maddie,
she calls from her bedroom. When Madeleine enters the brightly lit room, she sees her mother standing in just her underwear, trying to close the curtains in front of the window. Just outside the window, a pink child's bicycle is lying on the grass. The curtain has got caught in the door of the wardrobe, and her mother runs her fingers down the fabric and manages to pull it free before she turns round.
"Did you turn the light on in here?" she asks.
"No.
I mean this morning."
"I don't think so," she replies. "You need to make sure we don't leave any lights on when we go out."
"Sorry,"
she says, although she really doesn't think she had done so. Her mum reaches for the blue dressing gown on the bed,
her hands fumbling and locating it up near the pillow. Maybe Hoggy got scared of the dark and came in and turned the light on. Maybe, she says. Her mum turns the flimsy dressing gown the right way round, puts it on, then kneels down and cups Madeline's face with both her hands. Are you the prettiest girl in the world? You are. I know you are. Haven't you got any pupils today, Mum? Only Eric. Aren't you going to put some clothes on? Thanks for the suggestion, she says, wrapping the silk gown round her body. Put the silvery skirt on. That's nice. You'll have to help me find something. Her mother has a colour reader, but always asks Madeline if her clothes look right, if the colours match. Shall I go and get the post? Bring it to the kitchen. Madeline walks through the hall and can smell damp earth and stinging nettles as she picks the post up from the floor in front of the door. Her mother is already sitting at the kitchen table when she comes in and stops next to her. Are there any love letters? Jackie asks, like she always does. There's an advert from an estate agent. Throw it away. Throw all the adverts away. Anything else? A reminder about the phone bill. Nice. And a letter from my school. What do they have to say? Jackie asks. Madeline opens the envelope and reads out the letter, which has been sent to all parents. Someone has been writing rude words on the walls of the corridor and in the toilets. The head teacher asks parents and guardians to talk to their children about the matter and tell them how much it costs to clean up, money which reduces the amount available for refurbishment of the playground. Do you know who's doing it? Her mother asks. No, but I've seen the graffiti. It's really stupid, really childish. Her mother gets up and starts to take cherry tomatoes, creme fraiche and asparagus out of the fridge. I like Eric, Madeline says. Even though he calls the keys bits, her mum asks, filling a large saucepan with water for pasta. He said he played like a broken robot, Madeline giggles, which is absolutely true. Madeline can't help smiling and sees her mum smile as she switches the hot plate on. A handsome little robot, Madeline goes on. Can't I keep him? My very own little robot? He could sleep in the doll's cot. Is he really handsome? I don't know, she replies, thinking of his kind face. I think so. He looks a bit like one of those actors everyone keeps going on about. Her mother shakes her head, but looks happy as she adds some salt to the water. Chapter 34. Eric feels pleased with himself that he can play all the way to the 18th bar with his right hand, even if his left hand can only manage 6. Jackie smiles to herself for a few seconds, but decides not to give him any praise, and asks instead if he's been practicing the way she told him to. As often as I've been able to, he assures her. Can I hear? I've been practicing, but it doesn't sound right. There's nothing bad about making mistakes, Jackie points out. But you won't want me as a pupil if I play too badly. Eric, there's no danger of, and I really love being here, he goes on. That's nice to hear, but if you're going to learn how to play, you've got to... Jackie tails off in the middle of the sentence and blushes before raising her chin again. Are you flirting with me? She asks with a skeptical smile. Am I? He laughs. Okay, she says seriously. I'll try playing the piece I practiced, if you promise not to laugh. What will happen if I laugh? She asks. That will just prove that you've got a sense of humour. She smiles broadly, just as Madeline comes in, dressed in her nightie and a pair of slippers. Good night, Eric, she says. He smiles. Good night, Madeline. Jackie gets up and follows her daughter to her bedroom. Eric watches them go and has just put his left hand on the keys when he sees that Madeline has forgotten her stuffed hedgehog on the armchair. He picks it up and goes after them, turning right into the corridor. The door of the girl's room is open and the light is on. He can see Madeline's back and Jackie turning back the covers. "Maddie," he says, opening the door, "you forgot." He gets no further before the door slams into his face and bounces back. Madeline is screaming hysterically and slams the door again. Eric tumbles backwards into the wall of the corridor and puts his hand to his nose as the blood starts to flow. Madeline is still screaming in her room, and he hears something fall to the floor and break. He goes into the bathroom, puts the hedgehog down, squeezes his nose, and hears the girl calm down. After a while, Jackie emerges into the hall and knocks softly on the bathroom door. "Are you okay? I don't understand what..."
"Tell her I'm sorry," Eric interrupts. "I forgot the sign. I just wanted to give her hedgehog back. She was asking where it was. It's on the cabinet in here," Eric says, opening the door. "I didn't want to get blood on it."
"Are you bleeding?"
"Not really, just a slight nosebleed."
Jackie takes the hedgehog and goes back to her daughter while Eric rinses his face. He returns to the piano as Jackie comes out again. "Sorry," she says, holding her hands out. "I don't understand what got into her."
"She's wonderful," Eric says.
Jackie nods. "Yes, she really is.
My son is 18, and he's still never managed to switch the dishwasher on. But now he's living with his mother, and she's a bit tougher than me."
They fall silent. Jackie is standing in the middle of the room. She can smell Eric. A smell of clean clothes and warm wood from his aftershave. Her face is somber as she wraps her knitted cardigan more tightly round her, as if she were cold. "Would you like a glass of wine?" she asks. Chapter 35. Eric and Jackie are sitting opposite each other at the kitchen table. She's got out wine, glasses, and bread. "Do you always wear dark glasses?" he asks.
"My eyes are light sensitive. I can't see anything, but they can hurt a lot," she says.
"It's almost completely dark in here," he says. "Only the little lamp behind the curtain is switched on."
"Do you want to see my eyes?"
"Yes," he confesses.
She takes a small bite of bread and chews slowly, as if she were thinking about it.
"Have you always been blind?" he asks.
"I had retinitis pigmentosa when I was born. I could see fairly well for the first few years, but I was completely blind by the time I was 5.
"You didn't get any treatment?"
"Just vitamin A, but..."
She falls silent, then takes off her dark glasses. Her eyes are the same sad, bright blue as her daughter's.
"You have beautiful eyes," he says quietly.
It feels strange that they aren't staring at each other, even though he's looking into her eyes. She smiles and almost closes her eyes.
"Can you get scared of the dark if you're blind?" he asks.
"In the dark, the blind man is king,"
she says, as if she were reciting a quotation.
"But you get scared of hurting yourself, of getting lost."
"I can understand that."
"And earlier today, I got it into my head that someone was looking at me through my bedroom window," she says with a short laugh.
"Really?"
"You know, windows are strange things for blind people. A window is just like a wall. A cool, smooth wall. I mean, I know you can see straight through a window like it wasn't there. So I've learned to close the curtains, but at the same time, you don't always know. I'm looking at you now, obviously. But I mean, does it feel uncomfortable to have someone watching you?
It's not without its challenges, she says, with a brief smile.
You don't live with Madeleine's father?
Maddie's father was... it wasn't good.
In what way? Eric asks.
He was damaged. I found out later that he'd tried to get psychiatric help, but was turned down.
That's a shame, Eric says.
It was for us.
She shakes her head and takes a sip of wine, wipes a drop from her lip, and puts the glass back on the table.
There are different ways of being blind, she goes on. He was my professor at music college, and I didn't realize how unwell he was until I got pregnant. He started saying it wasn't his child, called me all sorts of horrible things, wanted to force me to have an abortion, said he fantasized about pushing me in front of an underground train.
You should have reported him.
Yes, but I didn't dare to.
What happened?
One day, I put Maddie in her pushchair and walked to my sister's in Uppsala.
You walked there?
I was just glad it was over, Jackie says. But for Maddie, obviously it's impossible for anyone to know how much longing a child can live with, how much fantasizing and magical thinking a child can manage to explain why her dad never gets in touch.
All these absent fathers.
When Maddie was almost 4 and was able to answer the phone, she picked up once when he called. She was delighted, said he'd promised to come on her birthday and bring a puppy, and...
Her lips begin to tremble, and she falls silent. Eric pours them both some more wine and puts her hand to the glass, feeling her warmth.
But you're not an absent father, she says.
No, I'm not. But when Benjamin was small, I had a problem with prescription drugs. Things got pretty bad, he replies honestly.
And his mother?
Simon and I were married for almost 20 years.
Why did you split up?
She met a Danish architect. I don't blame her. I actually like John, and I'm genuinely happy for her.
I don't believe that, she smiles.
He laughs. Sometimes you just have to pretend you're grown up and do what you're supposed to. Say the things that grown-ups say. He thinks about Simon and their backwards ceremony where they gave their rings back to each other, retracted their vows, and then at the party afterwards had a divorce cake and a last dance.
Have you met anyone else?
Jackie asks quietly. I've had a few relationships since the divorce, he admits. I met a woman at the gym and...
You go to the gym?
You should see my muscles, he jokes.
Who was she?
Maria. Nothing came of it. She was probably a bit too advanced for me.
But you've never slept with your professor?
No, Eric laughs. Almost, though. I did end up in bed with a colleague of mine.
Oops.
No, it was okay, actually. We were drunk, I was divorced and abandoned. She and her husband were taking a break. It wasn't a big deal. Nellie's wonderful, but I wouldn't want to live with her.
What about patients?
Occasionally you find them attractive, Eric says honestly. That's unavoidable. It's an extremely intimate situation. But attraction and seduction are merely a way for the patient to avoid thinking about anything painful. He thinks of how Sandra used to stop in the middle of a sentence and feel her beautiful, intelligent face with her fingertips as tears welled up in her forest green eyes. She wanted him to hold her, and when he did, she dissolved in his arms as though they were making love. He doesn't know if it was premeditated, but he still asked Nellie to take her on instead. Sandra had already met her, and it seemed like the natural solution.
So, who are you seeing at the moment? Jackie says. Eric looks at her smile, the shape of her face in the soft light, her dark, short hair and white neck. Rocky Kirklund suddenly feels a very long way away, and he can't understand how he managed to get so worried.
I don't know how serious it is, but, well, we've only met a few times, he says, but I feel happy whenever I'm with her.
That's good, Jackie mumbles and blushes. She picks up another piece of bread. When I'm with her, I never want to go home, and I already like her daughter, and I'm also learning to play the piano like a robot, he says, and puts his hand on hers. You've got soft hands, she says, with a big smile. He strokes her hands, wrists, and lower arms, slides his fingers up to her face, following her skin. He leans forward and kisses her gently on the mouth, several times. He looks at her, her heavy eyelids, her chin, her long neck. She smiles as she waits to be kissed again. And they kiss, open their mouths, and feel each other's tongues, tentatively, breathing tremulously, when the doorbell suddenly rings. They both start and sit perfectly still, trying to breathe quietly. The bell rings again. Jackie hurries to stand up, and Eric does the same. But when she opens the door, there's no one there. The stairwell is completely dark.
Mummy, Madeleine calls from her room. Mummy.
Jackie reaches out her hand and touches Eric's face.
You should probably go now, she whispers.
Chapter 36. An old woman with plastic bags wrapped over her clothes casts an anxious glance at Yuna Linna as he wobbles unsteadily beside her in the queue of homeless people. He tried to get some rest on the green line of the underground, but met a Roma man who offered him somewhere to sleep. He's been lying on the floor of a caravan out in Hudinge, wrapped in a blanket, with his eyes closed, waiting for sleep, but his thoughts won't leave him alone. He hasn't eaten or slept since Lumi left. He gave her all his money, keeping only enough to cover the journey to see Niels Orlian. Lack of sleep means that his migraines are coming more and more frequently. The pain is like a burning needle behind one eye, and his hip is getting even worse. An Iranian man with friendly eyes is patiently pouring coffee for the hungry and giving